IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam, this immaculate and infallible imam. There's a really beautiful conversation that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has. He talks about how it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who chooses his messengers and he chooses the people that he is going to appoint his divine mission to. It's a very interesting conversation, and it's actually a part of another conversation. But within that other conversation, we find that this important aspect has been brought up. You know, this is one of the fundamental teachings, at least, of the Shia school of thought. And that is the idea that it is Allah, the Almighty, who chooses his messengers, and therefore it is Allah, the Almighty, who subsequently chooses the imams. So unlike the brothers and sisters in the Ahlul Sunnah, who believe that the caliph, the direct successor, and the the imam can be chosen by the people. As you see that the first caliph and the second caliph and the third caliph, these were in some way, shape, or form, they were chosen by the people. And so in whatever manner that these three first caliphs were chosen, the main thing is that they were not chosen by Allah. But in the Shia school of thought, it is the Almighty Allah who chooses the leader, who chooses the imam, who chooses the divinely, this is why we say divinely appointed imam. So Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, in the conversation, he talks about how it is Allah who chooses from among his people as he wills in order to inform of his mission and in order to implement his authority over the people. And so it is in this context that Allah the Almighty chose the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi and sent his eminence with the mission of Allah to Allah's creation, even though there were some unbelievers from among the people who, out of envy and pride and arrogance, said, and then His Eminence Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam quotes the verse from the Holy Quran. He says, "Why was not this Quran revealed to a man of importance in the two towns?" So a historical note, this is talking about Umayyah bin Absalt and Abu Mas'ud al-Thaqafi. Apparently the people, the Quraysh, they thought that these two individuals were a man of more importance in the two towns, is most probably talking about the city of Mecca and Medina. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about how it was Allah who chose, even though people would have chosen somebody different. So the last point before we end, which we need to keep in mind, is that, you know, people, when trying to choose such a great position and an esteemed position, and, you know, something that is directly related to the world and the afterlife and the akhirah and the hereafter of the people is involved, the people might choose somebody who is incorrect, and actually most probably will choose somebody who is incorrect, as Imam al-Hadi is saying. But it is only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who knows who to choose to be his messenger and who to be the imam. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Discovering Islam.
Based on the Islamic teachings, the soul lives after the body is dead and decomposed. Based on the same teachings, the souls will be resurrected in their bodies on the Day of Judgment. However, the question is, where would the soul go in the interim period between death and the Day of Judgment? Would they live, or they will be in a state of oblivion? If they live, what type of life they would have? Do they feel happiness and pleasure and pain and agony? What about those souls who have not lived enough to attain merit or demerit? What about the children? What type of life they would have in that interim period? The world of the dead is usually portrayed as the most terrifying realm man has ever imagined, the realm of spooks. We are usually frightened even to think about it. However, based on the Islamic teachings, what comes after death and before the resurrection of the dead is a fascinating world.
The phases of our existence are divided into two. One is called al-dunya, this world, and one is called al-akhirah, what happens afterwards, the hereafter. Dunya is roughly divided into our existence as we walk about on earth and our existence when we lie under the ground. One is dunya, one is barzakh. Both of them are still dunya. They are not akhirah. So we define dunya as everything that happens before the blowing of the trumpet that brings an end to all this life. And that is divided into earthly life and barzakh.
Okay, there is the dunya and there is the akhirah. Okay, two very distinct. But there is a buffer world, or a world that in a way is brings the two together. You know, it separates the physical world of the laws of physics and the world of spirits. And the two, you know, because of their very different laws and incompatibility, really.
In barzakh, the souls, if you like, are kept in waiting till the rest of humanity catches up with them, so that then they can enter the new phase of their existence, which is to be arrayed in front of their Lord on the Day of Judgment.
With death, we enter a world of wonders. We will have dreamlike experiences, which is far more different from what we now know.
The awareness in barzakh of an individual, believer or unbeliever, is vastly superior to the awareness of even the greatest scholars who are alive now, because there is an element of certainty in the vision that you have in barzakh, which is difficult to get in this world.
This stage of our life, or this stage of journey towards the Lord, is called with different names in Islamic literature. It is sometimes referred to as the middle world, or the world of images, Alamul Mithal, or the barrier world, Barzakh.
Barzakh is a variety of passages into the hereafter.
Something that separates two things is a barzakh. And that's why this realm is called the barzakh, because it divides this life that we live in right now from the hereafter. Although it's a very, very long time in between, nonetheless, since it divides these two from each other and separates them, it has been called the barzakh, where people go.
We call it barzakh because there is an impregnable barrier between that dimension and the dimension in which we live now. it cannot be penetrated back after the soul has passed through it with the help of the angel of death. Now, the Quran states that after they die, behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
The Quran states, and beyond them is a barzakh, or a barrier, before the day in which they will be brought forth. So the Quranic picture of barzakh is some sort of intermediary phase before the major day of resurrection. Barzakh in Arabic just means barrier, something that separates two things, like we have, for example, in the verse in Surah Rahman, that the sweet water and the salty water have a barzakh between them. And, you know, these waters can travel together without mixing because there is this impenetrable barrier between them. In the same way, this barzakh, the intermediary world, because it is a buffer, if you like, between life in this world, and the Day of Judgment. And these are one-way streets. People do not come back from them.
There is a point in the near-death experience that a lot of people mention, in which they have a point of decision, let's say. It could be sometimes a barrier that they are going to pass, or sometimes it's just a perception that if they move on, it's like a decision made, either I come back or I stay. Come back, I mean, to the intraphysical life, to their lives back.
When we talk about the world of graves, we do not talk about the physical bodies buried here, rotten after a while. We talk about a world of a different dimension. We talk about the souls living in the spiritual bodies. Although they are connected to our world, but they live in a completely different dimension.
The grave referring to here, of course, is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave. You might have an individual who may not even have a grave. God forbid someone dies in the sea, and let's say maybe eaten up by the animals of the sea. So he or she may not even have a grave. But what we're talking about is the spiritual grave, not the physical grave.
Where is the soul of this body now? Does it really live inside this? According to our knowledge and according to the traditions that we have been taught, the soul is not related to this body anymore. The soul is living in a spiritual body. This body, whether rotten or kept intact, is of no use anymore.
The question that comes up is, why is it necessary to even have a barzakh realm, a barzakh world that we go to after death? Why not go straight to the hereafter? First of all, there's a fixed time for the hereafter. And in the Quran it says, عِلْمُهَا عِنْدَ رَبِّي, and the knowledge of the hour is with my Lord. So that has a fixed time, and now we're living in this life. And at the same time, we believe that the soul doesn't die. The body will die, will deteriorate. But the soul is to live on. Okay, so where is it going to be? What's going to happen? Because the hereafter hasn't arrived yet. The Day of Judgment hasn't arrived yet. Well, that's where it's going to be then. It's going to be somewhere. That somewhere where the soul is residing is called the barzakh.
What is the purpose of barzakh? My idea is that, of course, the Day of Judgment is a day when there will be a collective presence of humanity. But humankind comes to the earth and leaves the earth in groups. We don't all come together and we don't all leave together. But on the Day of Judgment, we all have to arrive together, which means that we need a holding area.
In this seir and this traveling towards Allah and movement towards Allah, this soul is developing slowly. They say that the barzakh is a place where souls are prepared either for the punishment or for the great rewards. In the barzakh, it is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will sometimes have people compensate for what they missed in this life so that they don't miss out on the good stuff on that side. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have a chance to do good deeds there. That is done. But still, those good deeds that we did in this life, those good intentions that some might have had in this life, will have an effect on their development in the barzakh.
The traits that we allow our souls to be occupied in, or the dispositions that we form in this world, they become like the seeds germinated within fertile ground. They sprout and they come to the fullness of their existence, just like a baby, through the influence of DNA, becomes a fully grown baby, a fetus, before they arrive into this world. So before we arrive into the next world, we fully mature in accordance with those dispositions that we have brought upon our own selves within this world.
It's in that dimension which question about the past life of every individual buried takes place. And that is the world of the grave. That is Alamul Mithal.
Mithal means image, but not like the image we see in the mirror. Rather, it's an image not dependent on mass and matter, hence more abundant with life and freshness.
Sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, and any other quality that we experience in this world are but faint shadows reflected from that world on the dull face of the matter. A world in which the heaviness of the matter does not slow down the life, just like what we see in our dreams or experience in our imagination.
The pleasure and the pain of that world and the duration of that world can never be likened to this world, because in this world everything is watered down. My fullness of my pleasures cannot come to the fore, nor my pains or my fears, because there are limitations through matter. But in that world there are no limitations.
The spiritual grave could be either a place of garden, heaven, paradise. Someone feels that he or she is receiving the blessings of God Almighty. Or it could be one of the pits of fire where the punishment will constantly endure.
The soul is subjected to confinement, pain, punishment, sickness, and grief, as they are to various states of joy, rest, bliss, and freedom. Now, all these are, of course, experienced in the spiritual body and not by the physical body.
In Barzakh, we would feel pain, sorrow, and happiness, absolutely, because these are aspects that deal with the nafs, and it does not deal with the physical body. Although they say there are some happy hormones in the body, there are some painful hormones in the body, but these would come as consequences, you know. So the soul or the nafs is what feels the pain and the pleasure. And that, since it never dies, it's not the physical body that feels the pain and the pleasure. You know, it's reflected on the physical body, but it's actually the soul or the nafs that is feeling it.
The Quran states that the life of this world is just play and sport, and that the real life will come in the hereafter. As the middle world or barzakh is one step ahead towards the hereafter, the life there must be much richer than what is experienced here.
The whole context that we understand this world is different over there. And therefore, it's very difficult for that human being. And same thing with the Day of Resurrection. Everything we know about that world and this world is going to be completely different as well.
This life is seen in Islam and the Quranic vision of Islam as being purely instrumental. It is a means to something much more. Okay, this life is simply a process through which we can start to fulfill the divine potential, which is within us, to live beyond the bounds and limits of this material world.
When the souls arrive in Barzakh, they find themselves in a new form of living in which the intensity of life and its dimensions are exponentially increased. The soul in its mithali body is the swiftest thing in moving relocating, ascending or descending from one place to another. However, based on the degree of their completion, they can be divided into various categories.
One cannot imagine how exciting the arrival of the soul to that world may be. It's so lush, so astonishing, so glorious, that it leaves the soul to marvel for a long time. It's an experience like the birth of the baby into this world from the womb. Now, the difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, whereas the baby's soul is very astute and can feel the difference.
There is a constant progression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at whatever age we go. The soul is not really bothered with whether it is 20 years old or 200 years old when it leaves the body. It is still very young in the great journey that is yet to come. It is an infant. It's just a case of relativeness. Yeah? Because when you're talking about the Day of Judgment itself being 50,000 years long, and Barzakh, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of years long, 200 years or 2 years old becomes very relative. The soul is still young, it has a lot of maturity and a lot of learning to do still.
By entering into that world, the soul moves one step forward, and its powers to comprehend the realities of existence increase. It is now one stage closer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord.
When the Prophet went to the dead of the Meccans that lay on the battlefield of Badr, he said, "Do you find the promise of God to be true?" The Sahaba said, "Ya Rasulullah, bal amwat." "O Messenger, these are dead people." He said, "No, asma'a minkum wa absar." He said, "No, they hear more than you do, and they see more than you do."
People in Barzakh are of different types, much more diverse than we see in this world. They eat and drink, but not of things of this world, and dwell, but not in places of this world.
Their food and drink and dress, their houses and furniture, their cities and neighborhoods are of diverse and dissimilar kinds. They may be poor or rich, beautiful or ugly, and happy or miserable. They are all based on what they have done in this world.
The Islamic tradition has references to three groups. Group number one, the believers. Again, I stress on the fact, believers, not Muslims. A disbeliever can be a Muslim. The believers who have acted in accordance with their faith, they practice what they preached, those will be enjoying some of the features of heaven in that world. On the other side, the second group, the disbelievers, could be Muslims, are unfortunately suffering from some of the punishments that they will be subjected to in the hereafter, after the Day of Judgment. And there's a third group who some of the tradition describe as they are neither the first group nor the second group. They are a group of people who maybe they were not subjected to enough knowledge. They will be in a state of as if they were asleep. God will just leave them.
For believers, life in Barzakh is going to be fascinating. They live in vast expanses with bespoken landscapes around mansions and palaces, furnished with luxurious furniture in their lounges and rooms.
They are served by innumerable some number of servants with inner and outer beauty, with no purpose but to serve their masters. Now bear in mind that none of these are physical objects. They all belong to the spiritual world, a world an image of which is reflected in our world.
All these are there to strengthen their love and appreciation for the God they are going to meet after this stage of their life. However, we have to be careful not to confuse this exuberant life with what awaits them in the eternal paradise, as the quality of life there is in no way comparable with what they experience here in the middle world.
We have a basic understanding of what paradise has: the beautiful scenery, the palaces, the service, the gardens. But actually there's more to it: meeting the Lord, proximity to Allah, seeing Allah with the heart. Seeing God with the heart is a theme that the Quran encourages people to think about.
Here we need to talk about one other type of life in Barzakh: the life of those who have died at a young age and have not developed into good or evil souls.
Compared to the grown-ups, the children who die at a young age have one advantage and one disadvantage. Now, on the positive side, they are sinless and hence open to any concept and wisdom that the angels may teach them. On the negative side, they have not developed concepts, feelings and thoughts which are prerequisite for ultimate wisdom.
The views about what judgment will be passed on those who have died at a young age differ. Most Christian theologians believe that only those children who are baptized would attain salvation. The majority of Muslim theologians, however, believe that every child who has died at a young age would be saved.
If a child dies before he has the mental maturity to choose between right and wrong, that child will continue to exist because he was born for eternity, but he will not, of course, be subjected to any judgment because he didn't have the mental capacity to choose.
They can only be taught to a restricted degree, and deeper aspects of wisdom cannot be known by them.
These teachings have two aspects. One, to teach them the wisdom and the knowledge that are prerequisites for entering that realm. And two, to cleanse them from the wrong teachings given to them by their parents or their society that is a hindrance for entering the holy realm.
Their purity is very different from the purity of the grown-ups. It is this latter purity and the depth of wisdom corresponding to it which determine the place of every individual in the final abode.
We have people out there who envy those who die at a young age. They say this child, this youth, he died before getting a chance to sin and before getting the chance to become a bad person. He's so lucky. But if you look at it from Allah's perspective, it's not necessarily something good.
Children cannot enter the territory of the righteous immediately after death. They live in a very beautiful interim space under the guidance and training of the angels to prepare them for entering that realm.
It's not an art. It's not something big to evade the punishment of the hereafter. That's not what we're here for. Not going to the hellfire is not something hard. It's easy. Allah's mercy is too great. Allah will forgive with the slightest excuse. What's hard is to gain higher levels of closeness to Him. So this isn't something that we should actually ask for. A person who dies young didn't have the chance to develop. Of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to be in a bad position on that day, but he won't benefit from all the good stuff either.
One cannot wait to see the wonders we are promised in the world of Barzakh, a world which takes us one step further to our final destination, meeting with the Lord. A world which empowers us to an extent unimaginable for us in this life. However, we have not exhausted all our topics about the fascinations of the world of Barzakh. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about those topics. Until then, peace be with you.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Sheikh, a passenger or a crew member aboard an airplane, flying at a high altitude and bound for a distant city, let's say a 2.5 hour or a half an hour to a 3 hour flight or journey.
Yes.
Has to drink water every 20 minutes to maintain his equilibrium. Do they have to pay kafara in addition to performing or offering the qada?
Well, if this work, like being a cabin crew, is necessary for him and he cannot take a leave or find another source of income, of course, in such a case, if fasting is harmful for him and maybe he will not be able to maintain equilibrium, of course, or balance, then he's allowed to break his fast by drinking water and make up for this fast later on, in terms of qada, of course. There is no kafara actually to be paid by such a person.
If a woman's period or menstrual cycle begins 2 hours or a few hours just before the Maghrib prayers, while she's fasting, will her fast be null and void for that fasting day?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because a lot of ladies happen to have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they observe fast in the morning, and later in the evening, to their surprise, they find blood, and they come to know that okay, their menses have just started. Of course, their fast becomes wide, even if it is 1 minute before the iftar time or before the Maghrib time. So they cannot make niyyah fasting, because fasting is haram for someone who is menstruating. So they should break their fast and eat something. Okay, even if they do not eat anything, fasting is wide. She's not to blame if she eats something. She can eat, and of course, everybody understands in the family,
yes,
that okay, every woman has menses, and she can eat without having to shy or feel embarrassed,
yes,
eating something.
All right. What rule, Sheikh Javid, applies to someone who immerses themselves in water wearing waterproof clothing, such as a diving suit, which does not allow the body to become wet? and it's not penetrable?
Well, according to the fatwa of His Eminence, as I read actually, I would like to actually read the same fatwa without having to change anything. This is the exact fatwa which I'm going to read. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says in his Ajwabatul Istifta'at, if their clothing has close contact with his head, it is problematic. It means it's a matter of objection. It is problematic to say his fast is valid. Hence, as an obligatory precaution he should perform, it is qadha. So this is the answer he has given, His Eminence has given on with regards to someone immersing himself underwater wearing a waterproof clothing.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil-Qur'an.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, is it permitted for a person to travel intentionally on purpose during the month of Ramadan in order to break the fast and evade fasting?
Well, there's no problem in doing that, even in order to evade fasting. Of course, it's better not to travel except for a good or necessary purpose. However, when traveling even in order to evade the duty of fasting, one must actually break the fast, because as long as you are traveling, you cannot observe fast. So no matter what the intention, maybe you are traveling for in order to, let's say, to get something done on a journey, or maybe your intention is to evade fasting, there's no problem. Some people suffer from some kind of, let's say, dehydration problem, diabetes, or maybe other issues. They prefer traveling during this month and in order not to fast. That's okay. He cannot fast as long as he is traveling.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, a person responsible for performing an obligatory fast, this individual decided to fulfill his duty but could not do so because of unforeseen circumstances.
Sure.
For example, he prepared to travel after sunrise. He traveled but failed to return home before noon. He had not done anything that invalidates the fast, except that the time for making the intention of an obligatory fast has elapsed or eluded his mind. And that day is one in which fasting is mustahab or recommended. Is it valid if he makes the intention to perform a recommended fast?
Well, when it's very much clear that as long as one has qada fast, he cannot make niyyah for mustahab fast.
Yes.
Like, for example, the 15th of Shaban is a good day to observe fast, okay?
Yes.
Or any other, there are many days on which fasting is recommended. You have qada fast, you have mustahab fast. You cannot make one niyyah, you cannot fast with two intentions. Meaning that you cannot observe with the intention of qada fast and at the same time with the intention of observing a mustahab fast. So you can observe one fast, and that is the qada fast, not mustahab fast. As long as you have qada fast, you cannot observe mustahab fast. That's for sure.
Thank you. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and shares with our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and also fasting. Sheikh Javid, we know that some people are addicted to smoking. And, well, this is sort of an epidemic here and there. No matter how much they try not to be irritable in this month, I mean, blessed month of Ramadan, they cannot abstain from conduct that disrupts the peace of their family and puts them into a nervous state. So what is their duty in this situation?
Well, it is obligatory for him to fast in the month of Ramadan, even though he is addicted to fasting. There are a lot of people who are addicted. And this month of Ramadan provides a very good opportunity for people who are addicted to smoking. They can actually quit smoking by fasting. I have seen a lot of people who actually made use of this opportunity to quit smoking, which is obviously very injurious to one's health. Now, when it comes to smoking while fasting, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that smoking is not permissible as a measure of obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually ihtiyat, this precaution. And I've seen many other scholars who are of the view that actually smoking is not permissible as a measure of obligatory precaution. They also observe precaution. And there are also some scholars who forbid smoking no matter what, no matter you are fasting or you are not fasting. So you just said that actually there are some people who becomes very much
addicted.
They become irritable.
Uh-huh.
They become angry if they do not smoke.
Grumpy when
excuse. Actually, he should treat others properly, and not smoking doesn't mean he should treat others harshly without any justification.
Sheikh Javid, maybe I should have asked you first this question. Is smoking a genuine invalidator of fasting?
The scholars, as I said, does not permit smoking as a measure of obligatory precaution. So there's
all ihtiyat. Of them are the same view.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the same view. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei is of the same view that smoking, and even many other scholars I know, I don't want to mention their names, they are also of the view that it invalidates the fast as a measure of obligatory precaution. And to smoke openly in public,
yes,
it's a kind of disregard to the month of Ramadan. Eating, drinking,
majority of Muslims.
And unfortunately,
fasting.
We do see some people having no.
What about narcotics?
It's absolutely forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's no doubt about it.
Doesn't it matter if the smoke is thin or thick?
The smoke is always supposed to be
thick.
Thick,
right?
Yes.
But if they claim that, for example, this is smoke is thinner than normal, it doesn't invalidate the fasting. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree. I'm speaking on behalf of a religious authority.
Right.
The same obligatory precaution is there. Okay, if they want to satiate that kind of, let's say, thirst for smoking, they can use a patch.
Right.
This is kind of narcotic patch,
yes,
or something. They can use it.
What about vaping? This electronic or electric type of new invention that came out into
again,
the market.
Again, there is smoke. Even
there is smoke coming out.
There is smoke coming out.
But it's not the natural smoke of cigarettes.
Yeah, it's not the natural. It is mixed with some kind of steam.
Yes.
Steam going into the throat.
Right.
And that's even more problematic.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. That's the host of this program. We bid you farewell, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
Happy Iranian New Year! Happy Nowruz! Happy Iranian New Year! Happy Nowruz! Happy Iranian New Year! Happy Nowruz! Happy Iranian New Year! Happy Nowruz!
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kazemiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan,
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, ulama and scholars all across the world of Islam during the history of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the life of an alim, a faqih, and a muhaddis of the 13th century Hijra, Sayyid Abdullah Shubar, mainly known as Al-Majlisi As-Sani. Sheikh Rouhani, first give us some details about the early life and biography of Sayyid Abdullah Shubar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Sayyid Abdullah ibn Sayyid Muhammad Rida Shubar Husseini Najafi Kazemi. This is the full name of this great scholar who lived in the 13th century of Qamari calendar. He was among the great Shiite scholars in that century, and he is among the trustworthy kind of narrators and transmitters of hadith of the Imamiyya. And of course, he wrote many tafasir interpretation on the ayat of the Holy Quran as well, and he was born in Najaf al-Ashraf. Then he moved to Kazimain and lived there for the rest of his life. And of course, he is known as Majlisi al-Thani because of his great works and books that he compiled in the history of the Shayu.
Yes.
Of course, he is Najafi, but he was buried, I think, in Kazimain. And that's why he is, of course, among the well-known Shiite scholars and narrators and Mufassir of the Holy Quran.
That's all right. Okay. Sheikh Fadai Sayyid Abdullah Shobar is known as a prolific writer, a person who writes a lot. That's why the Majlis Yassani, the title is given to him, a person who has so many compilations and authored many books. Just give us some details about the scholarly life, or it's better to say academic life, of Sayyid Abdullah Shobar. Then we'll get to more details of his life. For instance, his ideas regarding Usuli and Akhbari dialogues.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyidina Abdullah Shobar was born in Najaf, but he went to Kazimain and had his scholarly life in that city, I mean Kazimain. And yes, as you mentioned, he had a lot of works, scholarly works, and it is recorded that he had more than 70 books.
Yes.
And articles, and one of the reasons that he could have this success was the speed of his writing. Mm-hmm. He was known and famous for the speed of writing and, of course, for his great memory.
Yes.
He has mentioned that he had a very good memory, and sometimes he could write an article in one night.
Mm-hmm.
And once he was asked about this potential, and he answered that I got this from Imam Kazim alayhi salam.
Okay.
It means by tawassul and the ziyarat that he had. It was a special blessing from Imam Kazim that he could write very fast, and he had very great memory, and mm-hmm. he could write a lot of books. But it doesn't mean that just this alim, this scholar, had a lot of works. As you mentioned, he was known as Majlisi al-Sani.
Yes.
It means that he was like Allama Majlisi.
Yes.
Because of his various works. A lot of scholars, Shiite scholars, had various books. And this was a process in Hosea,
mm-hmm.
that after several years,
yes.
that you are just students, you have to be a teacher, you have to be an author.
Yes.
And
it was like something like a thesis or dissertation at the
yes.
university in today's world, isn't
yes.
it?
But you know, okay. nowadays in Hosea and university, they only if you are forced to write, for
mm-hmm.
example, because
yes.
of doctoral thesis, I
yes.
don't know, MA thesis, they write. But if they are not forced for the certificates, they do not attend to writing.
Yes.
But in our traditional Hosea, it was very ordinal
mm-hmm.
that an Islamic scholar should write.
Yes.
So he had more than 70 books.
Yes.
And as you know, he was not so old. He
yes.
died at the age of 54.
58, maybe 54.
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
And if you just think about his youth,
yes.
I know, for example, imagine if you stored their book, his books, in the age of 20.
Yes.
He didn't have a lot of time to write such a book. For example, in the field of interpretation,
yes.
Tafsir al-Quran,
yes.
he had three books,
mm-hmm.
Tafsir al-Kabir, Tafsir al-Wasit, and Tafsir al-Wajiz.
Yes.
And the second one, Tafsir al-Wasit, al-Johar al-Samin,
yes.
is very famous,
famous
in the Hosea. Because the first one, the Kabir, was not published
uh-huh.
for all people.
So it was authored, but it's not
authored,
published.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
Okay. So that's a pattern for
yes.
Hosea University, to use scholarly life,
mm-hmm.
write a lot. So the future scholars, the future students, they can use from our job.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, he passed in a life that, 13th century Hijra, especially in the cities of Najaf, three important scholarly streams, it's better to say, were active, akhbari, usuli, and falsafi or philosophical, usuli and akhbari. And Sayyid Abdullah Shobar was among the Imamiyah scholars who authored some works on criticizing some of the viewpoints of akhbaris. First of all, give us the differentiation, define for us what is exactly akhbari, usuli, and falsafi look and perspectives regarding Islamic studies.
Yes, of course. As you know, akhbari, the term akhbari is rooted in the word khabar,
yes,
which means narration and ahadith. So that is why these akhbari people or akhbari scholar are those scholars who just believe that we should refer in any details of our life to only to the narrations and ahadiths narrated from the Holy Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And we shouldn't perform ijtihad, which is a specific kind of speciality that,
yes,
that the scholars have, the usuli, let's say ulama, perform it to drive actually the ahkam and the, let's say, religious duties of the followers of Islam from the sources, from the main Islamic sources. So that's why, when it comes to usuli scholars are of the view that no, only akhbar is not enough. Then a scholar should be a mujtahid, a professional, an expert, let's say, in different fields of studies, and particularly in logic, in, yes, ilm al-usul, and to some extent in falsafa even.
Yes.
In different kind of fields of study, he must be specialized and, let's say, scholarly figure. And history, for example, so then he will be able to understand, for example, that a specific riwayah, that a specific hukm of Islam, is it adaptable, for example, for nowadays life or not? How should we perform it? How should we follow it? If we just directly refer to the riwayat and ahadith, because some of these riwayats are for a specific kind of condition,
yes,
situation, we cannot apply it for always, for example, to tell the Muslims that you have to fulfill all of them these things, let's say, in your lives. So that's why these akhbaris just rely on the akhbar, but usulis relies on ijtihad,
yes,
which is which means that they refer to Quran, al-Quran, ayat of the Holy Quran, to the akhbar, ahadith,
yes,
as well as aql. They refer to aql and they refer to ijma, the other, let's say, consensus among the scholars, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things should be applied in order to get the true hukm of Islam.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the main difference between akhbari and usuli. They had actually conflict for many centuries, particularly in these centuries that Sayyid Shubbar lived.
That's right.
That was also the century.
And Sayyid Shubbar was a criticizer of the akhbari, yes, perspective and outlook on that time. That's all right. But Sheikh Fadai, there's still a third perspective, and that is philosophical one. I mean, the akhbari one and the usuli ones were explained by Sheikh Rouhani, and this philosophical one. Can we say that, for example, the philosophical and the akhbari are two radical extremes of same pole, and usuli one is somehow the middle one, I mean the rational one and the middle one, or not?
You know what, akhbari and usuli are two opposite sides.
Okay.
But philosophical side, we cannot say that this is the third one that, mm-hmm, doesn't accept the other two.
Yes.
No, nowadays we have a lot of scholars, they are usuli and philosopher.
Yes.
But in the field of akhbari, you know, the akhbari scholars, usually they do